Good morning. This is Andrea Bernstein sitting in for Brian Lehrer for today and the rest of the week. Just a reminder about our Brian Lehrer Show Grub Photo Group. Coming off the heels of WNYC's Street Shot Projects, which drew more than 900 photographers to participate on WNYC's Flickr page, we're asking our photographer listeners to contribute to the upcoming Brian Lehrer Show segments. So tomorrow, we'll be doing several segments looking at food policy here in New York City, food safety, a look at urban slaughterhouses, the similarities between high cuisine and street food, and we've been asking you to participate in the discussion through photography. We've already gotten almost 200 photos. Did you see the one from Chinatown of the slaughtered pigs in the back of the moving van? Or all those great pictures we've received of street vendors and vegetable markets. Yum. So keep adding your food-related pictures to the Flickr group. Instructions are on our website at WNYC.org. Click on the Brian Lehrer Show. We'll incorporate the pictures into our discussion and maybe even bring a few of you on the air. Thanks, everyone. White working-class voters is a term that was hardly bandied about this spring as the Democratic primaries drew to a close. They voted for Clinton, not Obama. They expressed all kinds of doubts about the man who is now the presumptive Democratic nominee. But the moniker is just a new name for an old group. They've been variously known as the Silent Majority, Reagan Democrats, and Angry White Men. In their new book, Grand New Party, Ross Douthat and Raihem Salaam argue that high school-educated voters hold the key for creating a new Republican majority. This morning, we'll discuss how. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Thank you for coming on. Russ and Raihem, give us a little more information. Who are these voters?
Ross, do you want to take that?
Ross is white. Ross is white, and my parents are from Bangladesh, so I feel like he, being the more exotic of the two of us, he should take this.
All right, so the voters we're talking about are, as you said, they're the white
working
class.
Okay, let's just establish you both have college degrees.
Right.
So neither of you are in this category.
Are in this category. And there's a big debate about whether you define the working class by income or whether you define it by education. And we come down squarely on the side of education because to a large extent, income follows education in this country rather than the other way around. So the voters we're talking about are voters without a college degree, and that means people with high school diplomas. It also means an expanding category of voters who have what people call some college, which means, you know, they've gone to a two-year community college program maybe, or maybe they've done a year of college and then dropped out. And this is a pretty large share of the American electorate. So that's the demographic that we have in mind, and that's the demographic that's swung back and forth between the Republicans and the Democrats over the last 30, 40 years.
So these are people that can do anything? I mean, is there a particular sector in which they tend to work? Or are we just talking about people, whoever they are, who have not gone to college?
They tend to be concentrated in a couple of sectors, but the thing is that, you know, it is an incredibly broad group. You have a lot of non-college educated whites who are actually pretty affluent, who are pretty successful. You could have a small businessman, for example, who, you know, has a pretty big income, but you also have a lot of people with very small incomes. And with regard to that some college group, this is another very diverse group where actually Barack Obama did pretty well relative to Hillary Clinton. In Oregon, for example, he won a lot of these so-called working class voters, but again, the workers who have some college tend to be in different professions. They tend to be clustered in white-collar jobs, in service-oriented jobs that actually give you some wherewithal to get ahead, but they still have a lot of economic anxieties. So that's why this is a group that I think it matters to both Republicans and Democrats.
Ross, we seem to be having a little bit of trouble with your phone line, so I'm going to address the next question to Raihem, and they're going to try to get you on a more clear line.
Okay, sounds good.
Raihem, can you tell us why this group has swung historically from Democrats to Republicans and back?
Well, there are a lot of reasons. One reason is that this was historically a constituency that Democrats really owned. If you go back to the New Deal, for example, I mean, they really consolidated their hold on this group by meeting a lot of their needs, but also by matching their cultural aspirations.
Okay, Raihem, stop. I'm sorry. It's a little it's your line that is faulty. So let's go back to Ross.
Okay, well, I'll just pick up where Ryan left off.
Excellent.
essentially, you had a scenario where The New Deal majority, the Roosevelt majority, was very successful at essentially building a set of institutions and that addressed the very real economic anxieties of working class voters. And this is essentially the welfare state that we have today. The problem for Democrats and the reason that their hold on these voters fell apart is that they were unable to address a new wave of challenges facing America, but specifically affecting these voters in the middle part of the century. And we talk a lot.
Let's just be clear. When you say fell apart, you're talking about what period in time?
We're talking about the period from essentially the early to mid-1960s up until the Reagan Revolution in 1980. But it was an ongoing process, and in a sense, Republicans didn't consolidate their hold on this bloc until the 1994 Newt Gingrich-led Contract with America year, because that was the moment when they finally took over Congress.
Without dwelling too much on this issue, because there's so much to talk about, but when Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act, he said it's the end of the Southern bloc for the Democratic Party. So are we ignoring something by not talking about the role of race in this group swinging to the Republican Party in that period in history?
Well, I think that if you look at the liberal narrative of why they lost the working class, the white working class specifically, they tend to, I think, overemphasize the role of race. Clearly, race played a big role. But if you look at the 1964 election, which was the first election where this dynamic started to show up and where race seemed to be a factor, it's true that Barry Goldwater in that election, by opposing the Civil Rights Act, he won a huge majority in the Deep South, and that was the first time the Republicans had ever won a majority in that part of the country. He lost absolutely everywhere else, because the initial wave of the Civil Rights Revolution was actually pretty popular. And in the mid-60s, it was totally possible to imagine a future in which the Democrats cost themselves white votes in the Deep South, but maintained their majority or even expanded it everywhere else. And it was the second wave of the 60s, I guess. It was the skyrocketing crime rates, the sense of government dysfunction, the economic failures of the 1970s, and the sense of foreign policy failure that turned working class voters, not in the Deep South, but in the swing states, the Midwest especially, that pushed them into the Republican column. So we don't want to underestimate the role of race, but I think it's possible to seriously overestimate it as well.
Raihan is back with us. Raihan Salam and Russ Douthat. Did I get that right? Douthat are the authors
of... Yep, it's a tricky one.
Grand New Party, How Republicans Can Win the Working Class and Save the American Dream. I'm Andrea Bernstein, in for Brian Lehrer. The phone number is 646-778-3729, 646-778-3729, if you want to call in and join the conversation. Raihan, you talk in your book about there's a huge question of sort of, is it economic interests that drive this group? Is it cultural interests? At times, the sort of imagination, of this group has been appealed to on cultural issues. At times, this group has voted on the economy. This sort of issue and this tension and this dichotomy came up in this race during the Pennsylvania primary with the infamous bitter cling remark that Barack Obama made at a fundraiser in San Francisco, where when he was asked why this group isn't more attracted to him, he said, "They are bitter because of," this is a paraphrase, but if somebody wants to send me the exact quote, I promise I will get it right. But in paraphrasing, he said essentially that people are bitter because they're under such pressure economically, and as a result, they cling to guns and religion. Let's talk about how, one of the things that's really interesting is, Obama got slammed for making that remark. But it's interesting to me because, he grew up poor to a single mom, more than either John McCain or Hillary Clinton. He had very modest roots and ended up being an American success story. And it's interesting the way this played out in the campaign because he was portrayed as such an elitist. And yet, of the sort of three candidates now, two for president, he certainly could say that he came from the most modest economic roots.
Andrea, you hit on something really, really fascinating. I felt terrible for Senator Obama when that happened, because I know what he was trying to say, or I think I know what he was trying to say. And he was trying to say that, look, you know, you guys, you affluent cosmopolitan liberals who are donating to my campaign, you don't understand these voters. You don't understand where they're coming from and the kind of pressures they faced. And, you know, obviously a lot of people are going to be offended. They don't like to think of themselves as bitter. I don't like to think of myself as bitter. And I, you know, I get bitter sometimes. But I think that...
Although,
you know,
I don't know that bitter was the most loaded word in that comment. It might have been cling.
Wait, yeah,
I think
cling makes sense. No, absolutely. But I think that actually part of the problem is ideological, because I think that what, you know, we try to advance in this book is the idea that culture and economics are deeply intertwined. When you're looking at family structure and the breakdown of family structure, it's really had a very uneven impact on this country. It hasn't really affected the college educated. Their marriage rates are very stable. And actually, the divorce rate in this country overall has really fallen over the last 30 years. The areas where you have a lot of family instability, where you see a real increase in the illegitimacy rate, is with non-college educated whites. So when you see the fervor over an issue like gay marriage, I really don't think it's motivated by a hatred of a minority group or something like that. I think it's really motivated by a sense that all of these things that, you know, voters cling to, quote unquote, are things that really matter and give you some economic stability in a world of very rapid, confusing, and oftentimes very disturbing change. I think that when you look at the way this country has changed over the last 30 years since my folks came here, it's staggering. I mean, the demographic composition is radically different. The economy is totally different. It's a really different country. And if you've grown up over those circumstances, you had a certain set of expectations at the start of that time, you know, can you imagine how that must feel? We live in big cities on the East Coast, and we have a very different perspective on this kind of thing. We seek out diversity. But I think that when you're, you know, you have a high school diploma and you think that's going to be enough to get you, you know, a solid manufacturing job, the world looks really different and pretty scary, I think.
One of the things that you seem to do in your book is agree with the late Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan that family units don't break apart as a result of economic stability, but that economic stability and poverty are caused by family disintegrations. I'm wondering, though, how that relates to something like guns, which presumably has not that much to do with whether your family stays together and whether you are in a household that can care for you economically and in other ways.
It's about respect, yeah. I think. I think that when you think about guns, they are a very important part of the life of a lot of Americans, and it's about respecting traditions of different kinds of people. I think that, you know, one problem with President Bush is the idea of compassion, and this is a problem that liberals have too, the idea that poor Americans, working Americans, need our compassion and our help, and we need to, you know, kind of look down on them and pat them on the heads. But actually, you know, people, we have a lot of different folk traditions in this country. For example, look at Barack Obama and how well he did with working class voters in Oregon. He did great with them, a more secular place, a place that's culturally different. But he doesn't, for whatever reason, seem to get the culture of Americans who grow up with guns, for whom guns matter a lot. But then there's another aspect of this, which is that, you know, what Ross was talking about with regards to crime, there was a period of a huge explosion in crime rates, and that's actually when a lot of the gun culture in this country became really entrenched and became really popular outside of those older cultural, you know, groups.
Yeah, if you look back at the late 60s and early 70s, this is the period. Obviously, there's always been a gun culture in this country, and a strong one, but that's the period when, you know, NRA membership explodes and when gun control becomes an enormously politically potent issue. And it's interesting that if you look over the last 10 years as the crime rate has fallen, the debate over gun control has sort of fallen off the radar screen a little bit as well. I mean, people talk about guns and gays, but in the last few election cycles, I don't think guns have played a huge role. But
Democrats,
I think,
conceded the point to some extent too.
No, they did. It was an issue Republicans won on. But yeah. I think it's a case where, and this is something we talk a lot about in the book, where, you know, there's a tendency among liberals to say, well, you know, these things are symbolic issues. Guns are a symbolic issue. Marriage is a symbolic issue. For working class Americans, they aren't symbolic issues. They're issues that are tied directly to their family's well-being, their family's economic success, their family's safety, and so on. And this is something that, you know, it matters for both parties. Democrats need to realize that these aren't just symbolic issues, that they have real-world consequences. Republicans need to, and this is what we talk about in the book, you need to stop just coasting on the symbolism. You need to have policy substance that matches your symbolic appeals.
Let's talk about that in a moment. 646-778-3729 if you want to get in on the conversation. Reagan won these groups. George H.W. Bush lost them in 1992 to Bill Clinton. Why?
Well, he actually lost them to Ross Perot in large number. When you look at how much he won, 19% of the vote, he won a lot of working-class white strivers. I mean, it's interesting, and Bill Clinton did make some gains. He made some gains in places like Macomb County. But it's interesting how Clinton, you know, navigated this group, because you mentioned that Obama comes from a kind of hardscrabble background. Bill Clinton came from a white working-class background, if there ever was one, and yet he had a hard time connecting with him, and it's really whereas George W. Bush, I mean, he went to Yale, he went to Andover, I mean, you know, grew up in this really rich Connecticut Yankee family.
Really? I thought he just lived in Texas.
Well, I think that's what
he
wants.
He was born and raised in the Briar Patch.
But I think that, you know, it's interesting because it really is about the story that you tell and how you connect with people on a visceral level. And it's about those, you know, kind of and I think that that's
But
know,
why then Hillary Clinton,
with.
Right? I mean, they loved Hillary Clinton. I just, you know, saw people in, you know, some areas of rural Pennsylvania five deep on the rope line. You know, she was sort of criticized through much of her, you know, first lady years as being, you know, Chardonnay sipping and all of that. Why did they love Hillary Clinton so much? And was it just an issue of they preferred her over Barack Obama?
Well, my mom loves Hillary Clinton, too. And my mom is a woman who's been working. She, you know, got married pretty young. She didn't have all the educational opportunities that she could have had she been born, you know, 10, 20 years later. Hillary Clinton did have a lot of educational opportunities, but I think a lot of women, and some men, too, connect with her as someone who is an underdog, someone who is scrappy, someone who really did get, you know, criticized a lot of the time pretty unfairly. What was a big criticism from feminists, for example? It was for sticking with her husband. And that's something that a lot of people viscerally get. So I think that there are a lot of things about her biography, again, that though she came from a middle-class, upper-middle-class family, she was a Goldwater girl, really connect with people on a deep level.
There's also the sense in which I think that it's interesting because in 92, and again to a lesser extent in 96, Bill Clinton did have trouble connecting with working-class voters. But the long-term impact of the Clinton years, that economic boom, that was the best time for working-class voters, I think, in the last 30 years economically in this country's history, and not just because the economy was doing well. All these social indicators, out-of-wedlock births, teen births, divorce rates, and so on, were improving. And I think there is a sense in which Hillary Clinton was associated with that. You know, it was she got attacked a fair amount for the idea that, oh, she's just running for a third Clinton term. But I think that the third Clinton term is a tremendously appealing proposition to the people who benefited the most during that era.
Let's take some calls. John from Bergen County. Hi, you're on the Brian Lehrer Show.
Good morning, Andrea. I'm listening to your author of that book, and I disagree with him completely with regard to the fact of race not being a major factor. Back in 1968, of course, in 64, the Civil Rights Act was passed, which had an impact, as Johnson said, on the Civil Rights Movement in terms of the South going toward the Republicans. 68, we had the riots, which inflamed many whites who were frightened now by the threat of blacks entering their territories. And, of course, that was played upon by the Republicans in the fact that and even now when they get emails from people, had one recently in which they talk about the welfare woman who goes and gets a check for $500 a month, and ha, 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 we know what that means. Meanwhile, when you read in the papers about, in today's paper, for example, these manufacturers of all this equipment that they buy for Medicare, charging twice the price of Medicare equipment, that doesn't seem to bother the people. It bothers them when someone is stealing $400 or $500 a month on welfare checks. As Reagan said, you know, we don't want that welfare queen from Chicago driving a Cadillac. That is what sticks in people's mind for the white folks. And that's why the Southern whites particularly have voted Republican, because they have a resentment towards what they feel is unfair advantage given to black people both in the North as well as the South. What's the reason? What is the reason that the unions have never prospered in the South? Because the Southern whites have always said, God, if you have unions, it means you have to integrate with blacks. You don't want that. So,
John, thanks for your call. You've made many interesting points. Let's get an answer from Ross Douthat and Raihan Salam, who are the authors of the book Grand New Party.
Well, I think, you know, you raise a lot of really interesting points, John, and I think that, you know, one thing is when you're looking at our book, I mean, a big part of our argument is that a lot of mothers on welfare before the welfare reform actually were in a really tough spot. They were actually working. There's this perception that mothers on welfare didn't really work. That's not true. A lot of mothers did work, but they were very afraid. They were afraid of losing their health care, and they were afraid of losing their benefits simply because they were actually trying to do right by their families. So one of the nice things about the welfare reform is that it actually legitimized that. It allowed these women to enter the mainstream economy. And I think that a big part of our agenda is actually to help that process along, to see to it that actually people don't have to engage in sneaking around. Because I don't think that's, you know, fraud that we should stigmatize. That's women being heroes for their children. But of course, it's something that makes people upset when they feel like they're playing by the rules and other people aren't playing by the rules. And so to what extent is that about race? And to what extent is that about gut-level feelings of fairness? I think that when you look at a lot of working-class black families, a lot of working-class families of color who are die-hard Democrats, like my folks and the kind of people that I grew up with in Brooklyn, they have that sense, too. You know, people called them Archie Bunkers, except they were Latino and they were Asian American. So I think that that's something that you see a lot of in a lot of different contexts. And, you know, with regard to the riots, I mean, I live in Washington, D.C. now. This town was transformed by the riots. A lot of my friends, you know, black middle-class families that grew up here for a long period of time, it's something that still brings people to tears. This is something that really tore through the fabric of the society and our cities. And I think that it's something that, yes, did have a racial component, but I think that it's wrong for us to dismiss all of these feelings as racist, particularly when they come from people who come up and down the spectrum, from immigrants, from people who just really thought, you know, the city that I loved has been torn apart by crime, and we need solutions.
Well, I mean, I think that there's some interesting trends that we should think about in this election. For example, in the states with the smallest African-American populations during the primary, Barack Obama did best among whites. So there was this pattern of the sort of places where there was the least amount of economic competition. Obama, you know, white people seemed more willing to go and to vote for Barack Obama.
Oh, but there are a lot of other things that work, too. David Sirota called that the race chasm, and it's an interesting idea, the idea that in states where you have a tradition of racial political competition that, you know, you had Hillary Clinton doing better. I think the trouble is that in a lot of those states, you also have very few Democrats, or the Democratic population is skewed towards, you know, professionals and sort of folks, you know, who tend to be more inclined to support Barack Obama regardless. So I agree that that's...
Yeah, but I mean, look at Pennsylvania. I mean, you know, I mean, everybody is in Pennsylvania. It's Philadelphia, it's Pittsburgh, and it is Appalachia.
Yeah, it is. It is a complicated state, but I also think that in Pennsylvania, I mean, you know, could it be that Obama has connected, if you look at his donor base of 1.5 million Americans who, you know, tend to skew towards those with six-figure incomes, tend to have very enlightened views about a lot of issues, but don't necessarily connect on the gut-level economic issues that, you know, Hillary Clinton staked her campaign on. I'm not an apologist for Hillary Clinton, but I do think that she did a good job of demonstrating that, you know, she was on top of the policy substance and was really connecting to the kind of voters that you see a lot of in Pennsylvania. And also, when you look at, you know, Rendellicans, the people who supported Ed Rendell, who is a big Clinton supporter. So when you look at, you know, Barack Obama had less support with kind of suburban upper middle class voters, there are a lot of different factors. And I know it's tempting for Obama supporters to say that, well, you know, they were being manipulated or there's race going on, et cetera. And I think that maybe it's just that Hillary Clinton just really connected with that state.
Well, let me just say, though, I mean, I think it would be a disservice to deny the effects of race in this race. I mean, I know that I met people, Democrats and Republicans in places like southern Indiana, which is practically Kentucky, who said, I don't like the war. I feel like the Bushes have made a mess of things in Iraq, but there's no way I'm going to vote to put the Clintons back in the White House. So when I said to them, well, what about Barack Obama? There was a sense of pause. No, I'm not ready to vote for him.
Right.
So, I mean, it's real.
No, I think that if you look, there's no question that there's still a segment of the American population among Democrats as well as among Republicans that's deeply uncomfortable with the idea of voting for a black man. I don't think that we want to minimize that. I think what Reihan's just saying is that it's one of a lot of different cross-cutting factors in this race. And that population is concentrated among Americans over 50, over 60. It is a generational thing as well. And this is an interesting factor in this election that, you know, you do have this, I mean, John McCain is, you know, in his 70s himself. And, you know, one of his few advantages in what is otherwise almost certainly a Democratic year is that he is going to capture probably, you know, a few extra percentage points in an older demographic that's uncomfortable with voting for an African American.
So let's talk about the rest of the year. Who do these groups belong to in this election?
Well,
does McCain own them or does Obama own them?
I think that it's really not clear at all, because I think that when you see in general election, when you don't have Hillary Clinton there, I think that you're going to see a lot of these voters who might turn to Barack Obama because he speaks their economic language. I think that a lot of these concerns, I think that that's one problem that a lot of our fellow Republicans have had. They've looked to Hillary Clinton's success and thought, aha, we own those. There we go. We can win those votes very easily. And I don't think that's really true. I think that Republicans really do need to frame an economic message that makes sense to and that connects with these voters. And that's a big part of what our book is all about.
Do you see that happening? Do
you
see anything in the McCain campaign that is trending in the direction that you'd like? I mean, I know you have a set of specific policy proposals, increasing the child care tax credit, health savings accounts. Do you see McCain going in that direction?
I mean, I think McCain, in the broadest sense, has gone in the right direction, sort of casting himself, as he's always been, as a reformist Republican, as a foe of special interests. And he has, you know, in sort of small bore ways, adopted versions of some of the things we've pushed for. His health care plan is, you know, imperfect from our point of view, but not bad. And his he has made proposals along the lines of increasing the child tax credit, though to a much lower extent than we argue for. But the problem for McCain, and this has been a problem throughout his career, is that he is attracted to the kind of reformist causes that really resonate with the New York Times editorial board, or you know, or the upper middle
the
class.
The dreaded.
Sort of, well, think about, I mean, campaign finance.
That's a curse in some areas of the country among Republicans. Everyone should understand that.
It is, but more importantly, it's something that, you know, if you're a swing voter, if you're a working class swing voter in, say, Ohio or Michigan, do you care about campaign finance reform? Do you care that much that, you know, John McCain championed anti-tobacco legislation? Or if you look at where he's deviated from Republican orthodoxy today, it's on global warming, which, you know, may be a tremendously important issue. It's not a kitchen table issue. And this has always been McCain's problem. He likes talking about sort of grand causes and, you know, fighting the special interests in Washington and busting pork barrel spending. He's much less comfortable talking about health care, education, these kind of issues.
And yet, I mean, one thing that McCain does have in common with Hillary Clinton is credibility on the I can get it done issue, which is something that I think, you know, it wasn't only, you know, who Hillary Clinton was and what she was saying, but there seemed to be some faith that she could actually make things happen. So, I mean, does that enter into this debate?
Well, it's interesting because I think that, you know, McCain has certainly been in the Senate for a really long time, but does he really have that kind of executive experience? I think that what Hillary Clinton had was a staff. She had a lot of people who were around her around the first Clinton administration, and so when she said she's ready on day one, I think what it really meant is that Gene Sperling is ready on day one. All of these other folks, Bob Rubin is ready on day one. They had been in the government, and they knew what to do. And I think that when you look at McCain, I think that he has a lot of reformist Republicans around him, but are they people who have the experience? Are they, you know, Republicans who've been, because he is someone who is a weird figure in the Republican Party because he's been a maverick, because he's someone who's been at odds with the Republican establishment in a lot of ways. So, you know, there are two ways he could go.
So are you throwing in the towel now?
Oh, no, absolutely not. Look, I'm a strong supporter of John McCain, and I think Ross is too. The big reason is because of foreign policy. On domestic policy, I think he needs to do a lot of work. And I think that, frankly, Barack Obama is a really creative guy who I think gets a lot of the anxieties of working-class Americans. The problem is that I don't think that his policy substance is right. I mean, I think there's more of it there, and the Democrats have been thinking a lot about a lot of the issues that Ross and I care about. But I think that actually a lot of their proposals are things that actually might make matters worse rather than better. And that's what we're genuinely a little worried about. And we hope that the Republicans can frame better alternatives rather than just, you know, put their hands over their ears and go na-na-na and pretend that domestic policy doesn't matter.
Right. Well, I know that the Barack Obama campaign is looking at a lot of these voters in a lot of these swing states and saying, we need to convince them to vote their economic interests. I want to thank Ross Douthat and Raihan Salon, the authors of Grand New Party, How Republicans Can Win the Working Class and Save the American Dream. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks very much, Andrea. Thanks so much for having us on. It was a pleasure.
I'm Andrea Bernstein, in for Brian Lehrer, and we will be back to talk about the latest Supreme Court rulings and more after this.